Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. Not a whole lot happening this week as we're gearing up for the beginning of the holiday season with Thanksgiving around the corner, but God, the stories that are out are fucking wild. So let's start with Rockmond Dunbar, who was a regular on 911 since the beginning of the series. If you watch 911 this past week, he plays Michael, who was Angela Bassett's character Athena, her ex-husband, who early on in the series came out as gay and is the father of her children, but for the past few seasons has been living with his male partner, and Athena has moved on and has married Bobby, played by Peter Krause. So everyone's happy, whatever, but Michael has still been a presence on the show. He's gotten his own little storylines. Like I said, he met this man that he is now, as of this episode, engaged to, and, you know, has always been around as the father of Athena's children and a friend to Bobby at this point. So, you know, on and on and yada yada. But in this past week's episode, the man that he is now in a relationship with is a doctor. And in the world of 911, there is an earthquake in Haiti, and the doctor wants to go help. And rather than have him go away for 2 months, which is what they make clear, that he'll be gone for 2 months, Michael decides to propose and then go with him to help, like, build homes. But then during the episode, they started showing all of these, like, flashback montages of all the shit that Michael had done over the course of 4.5 seasons and, you know, like, being with his kids. And it was as if they had killed him. And I was watching it very confused because I was like, okay, they literally said at the beginning of the episode, this is going to be 2 months. Why are they acting like they just killed this guy? And the next day we found out that it is because they completely wrote Michael out of the show. Which seems odd. Like, why wouldn't you just, like, give him a storyline that writes him out then? Like, why play this game of, like, it's 2 months, but then we're going to give you all these flashbacks, and then the next day announce the actor's not returning? But regardless, the reason, here we go again, he is not returning is because the actor Rockmond Dunbar refuses to get a COVID vaccine. Now, for those of you who don't know, 20th Century Fox, who produces 911, was bought 2 or 3 years ago by Disney. So again, Emilio Estevez-ing this shit, Disney has COVID protocols, as they should. So does most of California. So does, I believe, all of Los Angeles. So not surprising that there is one on the set of 911. And apparently Rockmond Dunbar was like, not gonna. Bye. I'm gonna give up my job on this very popular, very well-performing primetime broadcast network drama produced by Ryan Friggin Murphy, because I don't really want to get a vaccine. What is wrong with you? What do you think you're going to do if you refuse to get vaccinated? Lots of studios, I would say the majority of them, have vaccine mandates. You're not going back to work anytime soon. You're not going to go work in theater. What are you going to do? What is wrong with you? Now, he said that he pursued medical and religious exemptions and was denied. So basically, he doesn't want to get the vaccine. And his statement was, I applied for religious and medical accommodations pursuant to the law and unfortunately was denied by my employer. My sincerely held beliefs and private medical history are very intimate and personal aspects of my life that I do not publicly discuss and have no desire to start now. My greatest roles are as a husband and father to our 4 small children. As a man that walks in faith, I look forward to what the future holds. Now, there is no actual religious reason to be exempted from this vaccine. Let me throw that out there. As a person who works for an Episcopal church, there is no reason that your church should be giving you a medical exemption. It should be the opposite. Your church should be encouraging you to get the vaccine. Jesus said, love thy neighbor. So fucking do it and get the vaccine, you selfish piece of shit. That goes for Rockman Dunbar, goes for anybody. Get the vaccine. It is your Christian duty to get the vaccine. So Rockman Dunbar not returning to 911. And I'm just like, how many more of these stories are we going to get that I'm going to report on of like people who are just literally throwing money out the door, burning money, burning bridges because they don't want to get a vaccine that will not only save their lives, save the lives of his four small children, potentially, and also just ensure that you can work in the future. I just don't get it. Oh, so weird. Okay. The other big news story I wanted to report on this week, I can't remember if I've talked about this in the podcast before. I don't think I have, but Eliza Dushku, who I fucking love, she was Faith on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. She was on True Calling, which gone too soon, lasted a season and a half. I loved that show. Bring It On, True Lies. She recurred on The Big Bang on Bull, and she was on The Big Bang Theory, and she's wonderful. I love her so much. And she's been acting less and less recently. And we found out a while ago why that is. And part of it is that she was sexually harassed on the set of Bull by the star. I'm gonna say she claims and allegedly, although I 100% believe all of this. But that's just me. I also am not looking to get sued by any of the 20 people who listen to this podcast. She detailed sexual harassment again by her co-star, Michael Weatherly, who is the lead on Bull and who used to be on NCIS. And after she complained to CBS about it, they fired her and then paid her off to keep it quiet by having her sign an NDA. And she got a lot of money, but that doesn't help the fact that she was sexually harassed. So this week, she testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee as part of, I don't really understand how this part of committees and Congress and stuff works, but it was a hearing titled Silenced, How Forced Arbitration Keeps Victims of Sexual Violence and Sexual Harassment in the Shadows. And it's to inform Congress as they're weighing new legislation to eliminate forced arbitration clauses in employment and in consumer and civil rights cases. And they're going to vote on this bill. They were supposed to vote on this bill on Wednesday. I don't know how that turned out because I hadn't heard anything, probably because we ended up voting on infrastructure and Build Back Better this week. But regardless, this was back in 2018. Eliza Dushku disclosed all of this. She was paid $9.5 million to settle sexual harassment claims against Michael Weatherly. And she hasn't really worked since then. So, and it's because of this non-disclosure agreement that was built into her contract that she didn't know about until she complained and wanted to go public with her allegations. And part of her settlement was this NDA, but she did disclose some of the details in the Boston Globe a few years ago because the network released a version of events that were, according to Eliza Dushku, not true. So she went into a lot more detail this week, saying that in her first week on the job, she found herself the brunt of crude, sexualized, and lewd verbal assaults suffered nearly constantly from her co-star. She says, this is beyond anything I'd experienced in my 30-year career. And she never referred to Michael Weatherly by name, but we knew who she was talking about based on her op-ed. She said that he frequently referred to her as legs. He would smell me and leeringly look me up and down. Off script and in front of about 100 crew and cast members, he once said that he would take me to his rape van and use lube and dildos on me and take me over his knee and spank me like a little girl. Another time he said his sperm were powerful swimmers. Now, Michael Weatherly defended himself years ago saying, these are lines from the script. He was practicing his lines. Now, come on now. This is a CBS procedural. We all know that no one is saying fucking dildos in Bull. No one is saying my sperm or strong swimmers in Bull. That is bullshit, Michael Weatherly. These were not lines in the script, she said. They were incessant and demeaning and directed at me in the middle of what was supposed to be a professional workplace. She said again that that she feared for retaliation if she went public with all of this. Okay, what else? After one incident, she said, when she was doing a scene in which she delivered a courtroom monologue, Dushku said that her co-star shouted that he and his buddy wanted to have a threesome with me and began mock penis jousting while the camera was still rolling. Then, as I walked off to my coffee break between scenes, a random male crew member sidled up to me at the food service table and whispered, "I'm with Bull. I want to have a threesome with you too, Eliza." She said that the experience made her nauseous. When she confronted Weatherly and specifically asked him to be my ally on set and tone down some of the sexualized comments directed at me, especially since he set the tone in the workplace, he responded, "No one is more respectful of women than me. I grew up with sisters." Now, sidebar, we hear this all the fucking time, right? That men are like, "No one's a bigger feminist than me." Does that sound fucking familiar to anybody out there? Because it kind of should. Think orange skin. She found out later that after their conversation, Weatherly texted the head of CBS Studios that Eliza had a, quote, humor deficit, and that he, quote, didn't want me on the show. Oh, and what happened? She got fired the next day. Then, as she looked into her legal options, she found out about this mandatory arbitration clause in her contract that would be used to keep what happened to her a secret and was meant to protect the studios and the perpetrator, not the victim. Now, again, as a sidebar, this happens all the fucking time in the workplace where laws and rules are in place not to help the victim, to help the institution. I am going through something very similar to this right now with my job as a teacher, where, without getting into any detail, the way administration operates is meant to protect administration, not to protect the teacher. It happens in entertainment. It happens all the time that we do not protect victims of crimes. Think of Kyle Rittenhouse. That shit just happened. We don't protect the victims. We protect perpetrators. Dushku went on to say, "I was shocked to learn I'd signed away my rights to a public forum before even taking the job." Now, hopefully this does something. Hopefully Eliza going in front of Congress and talking about this does something to prevent this happening in the future. Because as you may know, Bull is currently still on the air. Michael Weatherly still has his job. Eliza Dushku does not. She has been unemployed for going on 4 years now because this one white powerful man said, "She's not funny. She doesn't get my sense of humor. Fire her." And she was. And that's fucked up. And then not only that, she had no recourse afterward because she unknowingly signed away her rights in her initial hiring contract. Now, she has, of course, a better deal than many because her settlement was almost $10 million. And I can guarantee that a lot of people who sign away their rights in these contracts do not get that kind of settlement. But it does not erase her experience and it does not erase the damage that can be done by sexual harassment in this way. So again, I'll look for information of whether this bill was voted on and how it was voted on in Congress. I imagine based on the current makeup of Congress that whenever it does get voted on, it will pass. But not guaranteed, so who knows, okay? And then finally, in our renewal and cancellation news this week, Renewed Party Down, which aired on Starz like a long time ago, I want to say maybe 15 years ago, got renewed for a revival third season starring Ken Marino, Megan Mullally, everyone from the original series, Jane Lynch, I believe, is coming back except for Lizzie Kaplan, who is filming another series currently. So that should be fun. I don't know who the fuck watched that originally. I know it has a little bit of a cult following, but okay. And then canceled, it was announced that in cancellation news, it was announced this final, this upcoming season of Queen Sugar on OWN will be its final. And also that the current season of The Sinner on USA, which is the Bill Pullman series, will also be its final season. Okay, coming up this week on the podcast, I am recapping Taste the Nation's Thanksgiving episode in honor, quote unquote, of the holiday, quote unquote, and also recapping The Real Housewives Ultimate Girls Trip on Peacock, which is a trip. So stay tuned for that. Now, I know that Housewives is not everyone's thing. I know that a lot of you listening to this probably don't watch, and I hope that you will start, because right now we are at peak Housewives. We had Beverly Hills this past season that just ended with Erica Jane and her ongoing issues and filming throughout. We have right now on Salt Lake City, which I'm going to recap for the next episode, we have Jen Shah, who is in the deepest of deep shit, getting arrested on camera while filming a reality TV series. And then just this week, her assistant turned on her, so she's about to go to jail. And now we also have The Real Housewives Ultimate Girls Trip airing on Peacock. Now, this is kind of, it's Housewives All-Stars, basically. And it's a bunch of women, seven, I think, who go on vacation together. This was filmed during the pandemic in Turks and Caicos. And it basically is like some OGs and some fan favorites from the most popular franchises all getting together in one location. And like, this seems like a no-brainer of an idea, right? Of bringing all these different cities together for one show, and then watching the way that it's filmed and how it was filmed and how long it was filmed, they should be doing this like 3 or 4 times a year. Like, stop giving us one season a year of these cities and making them 20 plus episodes and 4-part reunions. We don't need that. Give us things like this, because this must have been so inexpensive to film. And they got it done and in the can so quickly that they need to be doing more of these. And they already did. They've already filmed a second season, which I can't wait for. So for those of you who are part of the uninitiated, The Real Housewives Ultimate Girls Trip has queens. got Drag Race on the brain. Has women from Atlanta, New Jersey, Beverly Hills, and New York going down to Turks and Caicos together, and they spend 7 days on vacation, and each lady hosts a day or night event. Like, because on like the regular seasons of Housewives, they pretend that they all are hosting these vacations they all go on. We all know that production is just sending them on vacation, but it's kind of like that idea, and they're all staying in a giant villa together and basically like attending parties and going out on yachts and playing games. It's everything that we love about the Housewives. Like, the highlights of almost any season of Housewives are these group trips that they take. Speaking of Salt Lake City, they were getting ready to go on a group trip when Jen was arrested. they're usually the highlight of the seasons. So it's like basically taking the highlights of the season and combining them with the highlights of the cast, which is just common sense, I feel like. So for our cast, we have from Atlanta, Cynthia Bailey and Kenya Moore, who I could take or leave either of them, to be completely honest, but I love them on this particular show. Luann and Ramona from New York, who again, could take or leave, especially based on how racist they came across this past season, but love them on the show. Teresa and Melissa from New Jersey, who are New Jersey. We'll get into some of the fun shade that Teresa throws at Melissa, but still. And then Kyle from Beverly Hills, who I don't think anyone would argue is probably one of the most well-known housewives across the board, and currently probably the most famous housewife on Beverly Hills. And also has a working relationship with Universal. She's not only on Beverly Hills, she's also in Halloween Kills, and she is in a new Peacock Christmas movie coming out called Housewives of the North Pole. And it's all of these women. So that's what? That's 7. So 7 women, and they go on vacation together. And that's pretty much it. And it's just like, hey, throw a bunch of big personalities with huge egos onto a private plane and then into a house together and see how they react. And I'm sure that's why Ramona is there, because she's the biggest asshole. And she lives up to that in these first couple episodes. She starts a fight on the private plane on the way down there, saying that New York put Housewives on the map, which is such a fun conversation to have in general, let alone like amongst the housewives, especially when you have Teresa on the plane, because for my money, it was NeNe on Atlanta and Charissa on New Jersey that put Housewives on the map. It was NeNe at the first season reunion saying, close your legs to married men. And it was Charissa flipping the table. It's those two moments that are iconic. The table flip is top five Housewives episodes of all time. I don't think you can really argue with that. So for Ramona to say that New York, of all cities, put them on the map is funny to me as a Housewives viewer, and especially as someone watching the series and knowing how volatile Charissa can be and knowing what egos all these ladies have. That's hysterical. Then what's the first thing they do when they get in? Ramona runs to the best room and claims it for herself and starts a fight over the rooms. We've seen this happen ad nauseum on New York City. So it's just, it's, some things just never change. You know, it's like, it's Luann flirting with the straight married guy and showing him her tits in the middle of the villa. It's Ramona starting fights over the room and, you know, being, I don't know, speaking down to people and acting like she's better than everyone else. It's Charissa trying to prove that she is smart and not a freaking idiot by talking about where she went to college and how many books she's written, quote unquote, written. It's Melissa trying to assert herself as deserving of her spot as a top tier housewife, even though the only reason she ever got on the show is because she was fighting with Charissa at the time in real life. It's, you know, it's Kenya trying to sell that her marriage was real. It's all of these plot lines that we see on regular Housewives, but like dialed up to the nth degree. And it's just so entertaining. And like, there are just so many moments where Charissa, they all break the fourth wall on this as well, which is so fascinating that they all talk about the show in general, the culture of Housewives, the pressure of Housewives. That's all super interesting. It's very meta. There are so many moments where Charissa will talk about how, like, literally in the first like 30 seconds, she's like, Melissa's not an OG, just saying. And like, it's true. She's not. She was not an original cast member. But just for Charissa to have to like get that in of like, just so we're clear, I am an OG. My sister-in-law is not. It's just so funny. And then for all these women to talk about like the pressure they put on themselves to act certain ways, to behave certain ways, to be in certain relationships, to look for self-worth. There's a whole, I forget which episode it is, but the episode it's in, there's been four so far as of this podcast releasing. There's an episode where they talk about the housewife's curse of, you know, that like women will go on the show and then get divorced. And Kyle's very frank and saying like, I don't think it's a curse. Like, I don't think the show causes people to be divorced, but I do think a lot of women go on the show when they're in rocky relationships because they know that it will help them with their future independence. So it gives them a leg to stand on when they do eventually leave their husbands, because in a lot of cases it's built into the title. These housewives are not independently wealthy. All of their wealth and self-worth is tied to their husbands or their marriages or their social status or whatever. And then Housewives gives them a platform. It gives them an income. It gives them opportunity. And then they are able to leave their husbands. And like, that's a really interesting point to make. It's just, it's the best thing I think to happen to Housewives since Potomac came along, and Potomac is in its sixth season reunion. So it's been a while. You know, Salt Lake City right now, Salt Lake City is a top tier city because of all the Jen Shah stuff. But in general, like, was a good addition, but not anything that, not at the level of like, you know, early seasons of New York, New Jersey, and Atlanta and Beverly Hills and all that stuff. So like, this to me is kind of like a reset for the Housewives, because it was just announced that Miami is coming back to Peacock, which I'm excited for. I always liked Miami, and it's been almost 10 years, so I'm excited to see what that looks like. And also now seeing this show with how it's different on Peacock, I'm hoping that it like, that Peacock allows it to kind of have a very different feel and voice, and that will be really interesting. But it was also announced that OC is coming back, which I feel like has been absolute garbage for like 3 or so years now. And they're trying to like reestablish it by bringing back a housewife that I don't think they needed to bring back in Heather Dubrow. So like, I'm not really into that. I don't know. I'm Potomac is ending, so we'll probably be getting Atlanta soon, but Atlanta has been real lackluster the past few years as well, and the cast shakeups there don't inspire a whole lot of confidence to me. New York had a really weak season. Beverly Hills is currently filming and had a good season, but I thought the reunion was just not all that it should have been, and I think everyone's coming back to Beverly Hills, so like, do I need to see another season of Erica Jane's legal problems? No, not really. That like, we're kind of in overload on Housewives right now, and it's especially overload because it's just not really that great. But this series, Ultimate Girls Trip, is like restoring my faith in Housewives and making me remember why I love Housewives. It has the energy of early seasons because it's all of these original women, even ones who aren't on the show anymore. Like Cynthia, it was announced after this show filmed over the summer, or maybe it was April, I forget which. But it was filmed sometime earlier this year that Cynthia's not returning to Atlanta this season. So that's interesting that that's happening. They also talk on the show very meta and very candidly about gossip culture on the show, which I also found very interesting. Like, they directly address that while they're there filming, someone has been leaking information to gossip blogs because, like, literally hours after things are happening, it's appearing on Instagram. So I found that really interesting. Like, the approach to the show is very 2021, and I enjoy that because a lot of what I think does not work about Housewives is that they have not evolved very much. That we're still like stuck in this dynamic of pitting women against each other, of pettiness, of basing worth on their relationship to men. Like, I love Potomac. This season of Potomac, very much like with Wendy, has a lot of her insults and put downs to other women have been like, well, you don't even have a man. You can't keep a man. You're divorced. You're not in a real relationship because you're not married. And like, that's just gross to me to like place so much worth on like if you're married and if you're in a relationship. And I feel like that goes kind of across the board that Housewives tends to deal a lot in that kind of currency of you need to be attractive, but also smart. But if you're both, then you're going to be a target. You need to be attractive. So you need to have plastic surgery, but then you need to talk about your surgery. You need to be in a relationship, but that your men can't get involved in the filming because then they're going to be seen as too feminine, as getting into the middle of women's problems. You need to have a business, but it can't be a competing business because then it's going to cause drama within the group. Like, it's just, it's so strange. And again, we haven't really evolved beyond this idea. And I feel like this is kind of addressing that head on of like, we're filming these women who are strong personalities, who are fun to watch, who are quick-witted, who, whether they know it or not, are basically improv actors, and who just make for really good entertaining TV because they're such over-the-top people. And we're watching them have fun and we're watching them interact, but we're doing it through this like modern lens of what is it like to be a powerful woman and have your marriage fall apart? What is it like to be a powerful woman and go through divorce and go to jail? Like, Cynthia and Teresa have a really great conversation about Teresa's marriage, where for the first time we get Teresa admitting that going to jail is the reason she left Joe, that she never thought she would get a divorce, that she thought she was going to come back, but that when she got out of prison and saw him, she felt nothing for him anymore. And that she blames him for losing a year of her mother, a time with her mom, who died either while she was in prison or right after she got out. And that's kind of like that was the end of it for her. You know, we get Ramona being kind of in her own Ramona over the top gross way, being very frank about how difficult it is to be a single woman in her 50s when all she really wants is a relationship. Like, she wants to be in love. So she sees that in everyone. It comes across as her being over eager and kind of slutty, but that's just who she is, you know, that she wants to be in a relationship. We see Cynthia's insecurities of being in her second relationship after her first played out and fell apart on TV. Is that same thing going to happen with her new marriage? We see Kenya's relationship still falling apart and how cruel her husband can be through her perspective and how difficult it is to be away from her daughter for the first time. Like, we see these women as real people, much more so than we do on their individual cities. And it's just, it's really good TV. It's not heavy. Even though we're talking about these kind of real topics, it's never heavy. It's never a downer. It always has a lightness to it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the vacation aspect of it and the all that. But also, like, this is just smart TV. All they had to do was get these women together in a promotional blitz from this villa that I'm sure no one paid for because they're advertising themselves constantly. They pay for private airfare for them and salaries for a week. That's it. The series was filmed over 7 days and they're getting 8 episodes. They're getting subscribers to Peacock and eyes on Peacock. And it's just smart TV. Give us a whole bunch more. Do this 3 or 4 times a year. There's no reason you shouldn't be. They have so many housewives to pick from. And, you know, not all seasons are filming all at the same time. So get some ladies who are in an off season. Get some ladies who used to be on the show. Get some ladies who are currently filming. That could be some drama on their seasons as well. I just think it's smart TV. And like I said, they've already filmed a second season that I'm excited for because it's going to be all former housewives. So we're getting a bunch of women to Beverly Hills. We're getting OC, New York, and Atlanta. Also, get some Potomac ladies in there. Now that Dallas is canceled, get some of them in there. Get us some Tiffany Moon. And the second season was filmed at Bluestone Manor, Dorinda's Berkshire's home. So we're basically going to get a whole series of the Berserkshires. I can't freaking wait. So bring it on. I need more of this Ultimate Girls Trip. It's currently streaming. The first 4 episodes have already been released, and then future episodes are releasing once per week on Thursdays until December 16th. And they're all on Peacock. And if you listen to this on Monday or Tuesday of this week, so if it is Monday, November 22nd or Tuesday, November 23rd, as you are listening to this, the first episode is going to be airing at 9 o'clock on Bravo on Tuesday, the 23rd. So you can watch that there. And then if you'd like it, get a Peacock subscription. Oh, I can't talk. Get a Peacock subscription, which you should get anyway, because right now they're doing it to it. They're doing some really good stuff. So yeah, watch it. It's fun. Well, this week is one of my least favorite holidays, Thanksgiving. And to, you know, celebrate, let's talk about the Thanksgiving episode of Taste the Nation on Hulu, which just dropped at the beginning of the month. If you do not know what Taste the Nation is, you are missing out, and I highly recommend watching it. It is a culinary show on Hulu starring Padma Lakshmi from Top Chef as the host. And it basically tries to unravel what we think of as quote unquote American food and how that actually is all based in immigrant tradition. Since America is a country of immigrants, and we often forget that. The first season premiered, I think, last year, maybe earlier in 2021. And it explored things, you know, like the all-American hot dog is actually a German sausage and stuff like that. And it's really interesting. And the beginning of season 2 just released 4 episodes at the beginning of November, and they're all based on holidays. And the episode I'm going to talk about today is not my favorite of the season. My favorite is the Hanukkah episode, but it is probably the most interesting, and it's based on Thanksgiving. So let me tell you, first of all, why I hate Thanksgiving. 1, it is stressful. 2, it is an annoying holiday where our modern customs and traditions are all focused around like having as many people as possible in one location to eat a bunch of food that we like to pretend is really good, but actually freaking isn't. So, I mean, here's the thing. If the food was all that good, we'd eat it more than one day a year. You know what I mean? Like if sweet potato mash with streusel and marshmallows on top was any good, we wouldn't just eat it on Thanksgiving or whatever. I don't particularly like Thanksgiving food or what we think of as Thanksgiving food. Now, I feel like most of us, not most of us, but many of us do not like the people we spend Thanksgiving with a lot, but then we feel pressure to spend Thanksgiving a certain way. But my biggest pet peeve about Thanksgiving is that it's not a real fucking holiday. I get that it is a federal holiday, but like I'm a Christmas person. We know this. I have been recommending Christmas movies for a month now since before Halloween. And it really pisses me off when people who don't like Christmas or, you know, don't like Christmas music or decorations or movies or whatever, always use, well, Thanksgiving comes first as a justification for why we shouldn't start like playing Christmas music or decorating our houses or taking out our trees. And that's always pissed me off because Thanksgiving is like, it's not a real holiday. It's a federal holiday. It's a, as Taste the Nation makes clear, a propaganda holiday, and it's rooted in racism and the genocide of Indigenous peoples. And on top of that, it's just a stressful, stupid holiday where we all gather people that I feel like we'd, for the most part, rather not be with. Or if we do gather with people that we want to be with, we feel this pressure to make things perfect and lovely and wonderful, and that's just not the way that fucking life is. So getting into the episode, Padma travels to Cape Cod to meet with the Wampanoag people, who, if you are unfamiliar with the settling of New England, was the tribe that the English settlers first encountered in Provincetown and Plymouth when they landed in America. And there's not a whole lot of information, firsthand information of how those early interactions went surrounding the first Thanksgiving. You know, we're all, and the episode makes this very clear, that we're all told this like rosy sweet story of people coming together and overcoming differences and, you know, celebrating the harvest together and loving each other and sharing food and breaking bread and accepting and blah, blah, blah. And that's probably not all that accurate. The white settlers, Puritans, were pieces of shit. Sorry to say. They brought disease, obviously, to the native populations of the Americas when they arrived. And they basically leached off of the tribes that they first met when they got here and were taught how to live off of the land, how to build shelter, how to survive winter. How to harvest, how to plant, how to grow, all of those things. They got that information from the indigenous peoples, the Wampanoags in particular. And this harvest that they celebrated as what we now think of as the first Thanksgiving is not as, in the two firsthand accounts that exist, not all that rosy, and also not particularly what we think of as Thanksgiving. Like, we think Thanksgiving now, we think mashed potatoes, we think turkey, cranberry sauce, all that stuff. It was like more likely wild turkey, venison, ducks, perhaps, and corn, Indian corn to be precise, and potentially some cranberries, but probably not cranberry sauce because sugar. And all that, that there was not a whole lot of, you know, there wasn't like pie and ice cream and blah, blah, blah. It was the beginning of a harvesting for a long winter. And it was the beginning of preparations for a time that the settlers had never been through before. And it was all done through the kindness and helpfulness of the Wampanoag people. And what did they get from it? Murdered. They got their land settled. They got 60 to 80% of their population wiped out during the ensuing war. And the King Philip's War in the 1600s, a lot of towns of the Puritans were destroyed too. But for the most part, one in every 3 to 4 native peoples died either through war, disease, or hunger. So not a great memory for the Wampanoag tribe. And Padma makes this clear in this episode when she's talking to these people about their traditions and what they think of as Thanksgiving food. Because for them, harvesting the land means eating things like coax, clams. and making chowders with bacon and potatoes and clams. And it means bakes, like cooking with seaweed on a beach and then steaming lobster and clams and potatoes and corn and things like that for hours at a time. And things that we typically think of as summer foods, you know, clam bakes, that kind of thing, that is what they would have more traditionally have eaten and eat in these tribes as they celebrate Thanksgiving and celebrate their own histories as well. And then it wasn't, you know, to make this even worse, Thanksgiving wasn't actually even a holiday until the Civil War. So when I said this is a propaganda holiday, here's what I'm talking about. Thanksgiving wasn't really even celebrated in America until the Civil War. And that was when Lincoln tried to unite people during the war. Obviously, the Civil War, look at the title and go back to your middle and high school history classes. The nation was torn apart, and this fake story of the first Thanksgiving was seen as kind of like a metaphor and a comfort to people and was used to promote American unity. And that's a little gross, especially considering it was well known at that point, maybe not like well shared as a fact, but, you know, definitely not a secret that Native peoples were pretty much decimated following the first Thanksgiving and following the settling of New England. So, I don't know. All of this may not seem all that interesting to you, and I apologize for going a little serious with this particular episode, but Taste the Nation is really good at doing these topics that are heavy and that are based in, like I said when I was talking about what the show itself is actually about, based in these minority communities that actually have built what we think of as being quote-unquote all American. You know, like things that we think of as ubiquitous American foods, even just in these four episodes, like the rise of popularity of Korean culture in America is American, you know, Korean barbecue is part of American culture now. These Thanksgiving foods come from Native culture, that bagels and things like that and fried foods, donuts and sufganya and latkes and stuff, like these are quintessential American foods, but they're also ethnic foods. And that's really interesting to me to kind of go back to the root of these traditions, of these things, to rethink what we assume is American. And that's a lot of Padma's thesis of Taste the Nation. And for me, this Wampanoag episode is probably the most successful version of that thesis, because it's going back to the root of quite literal American cuisine. You know, it's not like we think of hot dogs, hamburgers, barbecue, stuff like that as American. And there's, like I said, a hot dog episode in season one that's really like, well, this is actually, you know, German. But what is actually American food is food that is from the land, is native foods. It's tubers, it's clams, it's things from the shoreline, it's native birds and animals like deer and things like that, and fish. That is actual quintessential American food. And getting the perspective of the Wampanoag people in this episode adds a heft to that and a weight to that. And there's no like, there's an olive branch, I guess, kind of extended in a way, in that she's speaking to these indigenous peoples and getting their perspective, but not condemning white people. Like, they don't condemn white people and blame white people, but they are fighting for their own rights. There's a whole segment on a local man whose name I can't remember, who is constantly fighting in Cape Cod with local authorities over his right to fish in certain areas, that as a Native person, it is his granted divine right to fish those waters and to farm that land. And he keeps getting in trouble because of licensing and stupid bureaucracy, things like that. And like, when does American law and American tradition and American pastime, things like that, when does that encroach on a person's God-given right to life? Or in this case, creator-given right to life. It's really interesting to think about. It's, the food all looks wonderful and amazing and delicious. And getting the perspective of the people who are trying to preserve this legacy, to educate others on this legacy, to bring back a dead language in one case of one family, and just to promote awareness of what Native cuisine is, of, and of where this actual Thanksgiving story came from and what it really means. I was familiar with a lot of this through a book called Mayflower, written by Nathaniel Philbrick, from, that came out maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, I want to say, that traces the journey of the Mayflower from England, the story of the first Thanksgiving, the first winter together, where the Puritans, Wampanoags, tried to live together, and then how it all kind of fell apart and ended in a war that, you know, all but wiped out many Native populations. So if you would like some more information other than this episode, which I, again, highly recommend watching at least this one on Hulu now, Mayflower by Nathaniel Philbrick, you can read that book, or you can just like do some, you know, some Googling and learn where these traditions and these notions that we hold so sacred so often really come from. You know, Thanksgiving as an idea is a nice holiday, and I know that that's where the modern idea of Thanksgiving comes from, is this idea of gathering, and it comes from like the pagan harvest, and or not the pagan harvest, God, I got Christmas on the brain. It comes from the fall harvest before the frosts of winter. And, you know, it's a time for family and relaxation and reflection and blah, 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 all that stuff. But the actual root of where this holiday comes from is inextricably tied to racism, to genocide, and to American propaganda. And yeah, that's always fun. So the first and second seasons of Taste the Nation, or at least the first four episodes of season two, there should be six more coming out soon, are streaming now on Hulu, including these four holiday episodes. There is an episode about Hanukkah, Thanksgiving, New Year's, and Christmas, following different cultures and how they celebrate those holidays. And I, again, I highly recommend them. So you can go watch them now. Happy Thanksgiving. Even though it is a holiday week and there's not a whole lot happening with regular airings of TV shows this week, if you are a Christmas or holiday watcher, you are going to be in hog heaven this week. I'm not going to cover everything that's premiering because I'd be here all day, but Hallmark Channel is airing a whole bunch of new movies. Lifetime is airing a whole bunch of new movies, including the Reba McEntire movie. GAC is airing some stuff. HBO Max, Netflix. They're all dropping a whole bunch of holiday films and specials. So if that's your jam, go searching in your streaming. Other than that, there's still a lot happening on streaming this week. So on Wednesday, Amazon Prime is dropping the third and final season of Hannah. Then on Peacock, we're getting the second season of its reboot slash revival of Saved by the Bell. Paramount Plus begins the second season of its Real World Homecoming series, which is reuniting the original cast of some of the old seasons. When they first launched earlier this year, they did New York. Now they're doing LA. So that begins on Wednesday. Netflix is dropping the fourth season of Selling Sunset, and also the miniseries True Story, which is a a drama starring Kevin Hart and Wesley Snipes. And Disney Plus begins airing its Marvel Avengers Phase 4 series, Hawkeye. On Thursday, Disney Plus is airing the first of three parts of its documentary on the Beatles called Get Back. The second part airs on Friday, the third part on Saturday. Netflix is dropping the fifth season of F is for Family. HBO Max has a whole lot of content coming out that day. They're releasing the full season of 12 Dates of Christmas, which, sidebar, if you didn't watch the first season, you have to catch up. It is the highest form of trash TV. I loved it. I loved hating Garrett. I'm so excited for this season. It's the only series that I know of that features LGBTQ people looking for love in a dating series. So that's why I watched it, and I'm going to watch this season too. Then also Gossip Girl returns for the first two of the final batch of its last episodes of its first season. The third season of Looney Tunes cartoons airs on HBO Max as well. And then on Paramount Plus, we get the South Park post-COVID special. And on WoW Presents Plus, the beginning of Painted with Raven, which is a makeup artist competition series with Raven from season two of Drag Race and RuPaul's current makeup artist. On Sunday, the Hogwarts Tournament of Champions series I talked about a few weeks ago with Helen Mirren about Harry Potter. That starts on TBS and Cartoon Network. The Great Christmas Light Fight returns to ABC. And then Portia Williams, who is from Real Housewives of Atlanta, gets her own spinoff series called Portia's Family Matters, beginning on Sunday as well. For finales, the Dancing with the Stars finale airs on Monday, if anybody is going to still watch that after all the drama I read about this past week. On Thursday, Drag Race UK crowns a season three champion. And then on Sunday, the fourth and final part of The Real Housewives of Potomac reunion with Nicki Minaj airs, and the final episode of This Is Life with Lisa Ling as well. So my countdown to Christmas recommendation this week is a real movie. It feels like a real movie. It aired last Saturday, November 13th, I think, on the Hallmark Movies and Mysteries channel. It's called One December Night. And it stars Bruce Campbell and Peter Gallagher. So need I say more about why you should be watching this? So the main storyline of this is Bedford and Sullivan is kind of like a Simon and Garfunkel type duo who broke up 10 years ago over tensions within the group. And they had a whole bunch of hits. They were a real big act, but they haven't performed together in 10 years. So they were supposed to be reuniting for a Christmas concert on TV. Only Sullivan, who is Peter Gallagher's character, doesn't want to do it, can't be bothered, but needs the money. Because apparently they sold their publishing rights years and years ago, so they make no money off of their music anymore. So they're trying to get together. It's not really working. Sullivan's daughter and Bedford's son are their respective managers. She works in music. He works for his dad, and they are getting together. They're trying to get their parents together to make everything work out. There's a whole lot of tension. Sullivan doesn't like the holidays anymore because his wife died, the mother of his daughter. And then we find out later that Bedford is struggling with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. So this could be his last hurrah. And he really wants the band to get back together before he can't remember anything anymore or play music anymore. So it's very sweet and very sad, a lot of it. And then the two kids rekindle their friendship, and that turns into more. And they end up, admitting that they've kind of always been in love with each other over the course of their lives as well. And then, of course, because it's a Hallmark movie, it all ends very well with Bedford and Sullivan coming back together, performing their greatest hits. And the son somehow gets the rights back to them as well. So they both will be able to make money off of their music from there on out. And the main reason to recommend this movie is, one, it feels very different for a Hallmark movie. Like, it's not the standard, like, small town Christmas party planning, we're having a festival, let's build snowmen, let's decorate cookies, let's pick out a Christmas tree. It's not that at all. It is a story about family. It, the love story is there, but it's definitely pushed to the side in favor of these relationships between the father and son, father and daughter, and the two friends. And that is really great. There's a side story of the daughter played by Eloise Mumford from the 50 Shades movies, who is trying to get represents a very talented singer, trying to get her on a tour. And that singer, her name is Jasmine Forsberg. She is amazing. And it's just, it's a holiday story, but it's not about Christmas. Like, I think that's one of the things people love to make fun of Hallmark movies for a lot, is that they like vomit Christmas at you. And that's not always what we want at the holidays, right? Like, some of my favorite Christmas movies are not necessarily like about Christmas Day. They just happen to take place at Christmas, like Home Alone being one of them, Just Friends being another, with which, by the way, the fact that is not a Christmas classic makes me so angry. Anna Faris in that movie is fucking brilliant. Ryan Reynolds is hysterical. I love that movie. I quote it all year long, all the time, constantly. Forgiveness is Mother's Day inside. It's so good. It's so good. Watch that. Anyway, but regardless, this feels more like that, where it takes place at Christmas, but it's not a movie about people celebrating Christmas or trying to save Christmas or Christmas traditions. It's a movie that is about people around Christmas time. And I appreciate that. Bruce Campbell and Peter Gallagher, as you would expect, are great in their roles. I kind of wish they maybe had switched roles, because I feel like Peter Gallagher would have been better as the Alzheimer's, as the person with Alzheimer's and that type of personality, but that's okay. You know, they're better actors than you typically get from these movies. And then on top of that, the music the original music that they write for the movie is actually really good, especially the non-Christmas song. They sing two songs at the end. One is their big Christmas hit called One December Night, and it's good. But the other one, I think, is called Coming Home. And that's like a legitimately good song. Like, if it was written by like Hall & Oates, it would have legit been a hit. So kudos to whoever wrote that shit too. Cause I mean, it rarely happens. It happened with the Leanne Rimes Christmas movie too. That felt like real music, probably because Leanne Rimes wrote it. But regardless, I really liked this movie. It was emotional, but not like heavy handed. It had like, I don't know. It's so hard to judge films that are like about Alzheimer's and grief and death and that kind of thing. And as much as it sounds dour and like a downer, it's not. It's handled subtly and well. It doesn't feel like they're beating you over the head of like, this is Bedford's last Christmas. We must have this concert because he'll never have another Christmas. Like it's not like that. It's very straightforward of like, you know, this is a part of me and I have accepted it. And I'm trying everything I can to make it to do as well as I can with it. If I stay focused on things, it helps. And that's why I have such this myopic vision of what this concert needs to be, because if I don't focus all of my attention on it, then my mind will start to wander and I'll forget things. And that is, as someone who just put their grandparents less than a month ago at this point into a memory care unit in an assisted living facility, that hits home for me. Yeah, so I really like this movie. Again, it's called One December Night. It's going to be airing throughout the season, probably, again, because of the pedigree of the cast more than usual, on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries. All right. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into this episode of Fake TV Critic. I'll be back next week with a little bit of a shorter episode, since it is Thanksgiving and there's not a whole lot going on, and I would like to have some time off to myself. How dare you be so selfish, all 20 of you who listen to this and demanding a new episode. But I'll be back next week with more recaps, more reviews, more analyses, and more recommendations. Have a good week, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving if you celebrate. Happy Black Friday if you don't.